Hi, Isabella.
Hello, Brian.
It's been a few weeks, but we were speaking last time about connecting different thinkers to Julian Jaynes, the ever controversial writer in the 70s who wrote The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
Mm-hmm.
That easy title.
And it's a terrible cover, too, because it's just black and white. It's like a white book with just that title on it. There's nothing to sort of... I just keep thinking about Julian Jaynes sitting back going, what should the picture be? And then going like, no way. Can't
no
think of anything.
Picture.
There's no freaking way to summarize what I'm trying to talk about here. So, yeah, it's an incredible piece of work. And I think it has... The last time we talked, we got into... You know, part of what I wanted to do was to... playfully connect a lot of the thinkers that are central to your own work that seemingly are incredibly diverse in totally different disciplines, and considering what seemingly are very different phenomena. And yet there is this connection with the way that they think about whatever reality is and how we conceptualize that and how we construct that, both on the individual and societal and evolutionary level. And I think Jaynes gives us some pretty compelling frameworks to think through many of the concerns you have in Neither Nor.
Yeah, and he is, in a way, kind of paradigmatic of the kinds of thinkers I like, because he writes stuff that's extremely provocative, kind of crazy, very loosely connected, quite aphoristic in a way, right? Like his chapters are very short. And yet there's something really powerful in that way of arguing. It's not exactly a linear argument, although it's, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very effective argument, but it's a kind of roundabout way of arguing, I feel like. And yeah, arguably so is Darwin's, and so is Nietzsche's, and so is, you know, quite a few of these other people that we've been thinking about.
Yeah, you've been reading also Wittgenstein and sharing that with some people. He has somewhat of a similar style in his aphorisms or ways of writing. And I think there's something important about that, because there's something important about also... We talked actually in the last episode about a writing style that allows the reader, or doesn't allow the reader, but invites the reader to actively participate in co-constructing the knowledge, because it's not all spoon-fed to the reader. And also there's an involvement that you have to have. There's almost an experiential involvement with the work that's really important.
Yeah, and there's this question of rumination in Nietzsche, where he writes about it at the start of Genealogy of Morality. And I mentioned this to Rupert Reed about Wittgenstein's aphoristic form, and he kind of reacted against it a little bit because he thinks that Wittgenstein is quite constructed and linear, like contrary to how he's taken, that there is more sort of ordering principle in there than you might at first think. And yet there is like this kind of interesting way of doing these really dense and interconnected arguments. So, and just to list off a few, so Schopenhauer has his Essays and Aphorisms, which comes long after his systematic work, as Tolstoy calls it. And it is this quite short series of little blurbs, basically, you know. And Pascal and arguably Michel de Montaigne also write in this way. And arguably even Spinoza, even though he has this extremely, you know, geometrical aspiration, he writes everything out in these kind of points that are supposed to build on themselves, and they refer to each other. And yet the end result is somehow kind of circular. And yeah, I mean, Schopenhauer says of Spinoza that what is good in Spinoza is not contained in the geometric proofs. Like he's good in spite of the fact that he tries to make it look linear and not because of it.
Interesting. It also reminds me, of course, of things like the Bible, the Old Testament, and Buddhist texts, and Taoist texts, right? They're all written in this kind of, in some ways, seemingly very dense, but still bite-sized pieces. And I wanted to sort of give the reader or the listeners a heads up that what we're planning on doing in, whether it's the following episode or a couple of episodes, is doing some close readings. And this is exactly, you know, the context in which what you'd want to do is take one or two of these or passages, whether it's Wittgenstein's or Schopenhauer's or others, and read them aloud a few times and then think through deeply, pretty much phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence, because there's so much in there. And the time it takes to digest is really important. So this is just a heads up that we're planning on doing that for this exact reason.
Yeah, and we'll try to choose a passage that is amenable to being read aloud. Many of these same writers that tend to write in this aphoristic way are brilliantly evocative writers. They're stylistic geniuses, I would say. And so they're not painful to read, although they are not, at the same time, always easy to understand. And there might be something related in these two facts as well.
Yeah, and it goes back to this idea that they are likely inviting us to work at these ideas, that they don't come easily. And if they were written in a way that was super linear and with a lot of sort of airy feel to them, it wouldn't make us stop and go, what is going on here, right? So I think it's incredibly intentional, of course, as well.
Yeah, this kind of stylistic arrest and making you kind of do a bit of work on your own to construct the argument. It does remind me of that passage that J. Hillis Miller looks at in Nietzsche, where he says, the argument is so difficult that it's basically impossible to reproduce even right after you've read it. And yet it's like has this kind of deep impact on its readers. And that's about Nietzsche's attempt to deconstruct the idea of the self, which of course Buddhism also tries to do. And I think it's great that you point out that the suttas are also like this, because I hadn't really thought about that, but they're also importantly part of an oral tradition. And so it does make me wonder the degree to which there's an element of oration that comes into these texts. Of course, the Old Testament probably has some of that.
Yes.
You know, the Greek epics and things like, part of it has to sound a certain way in order to be memorable, right?
Right.
Because the Buddhist suttas are these structured kind of verse-like things, but they're not really put into an order. They're certainly not in the way that we receive them today. They're not in the order of the way of being written or something like that. They're in the order of length so that multiple monks could memorize the right size chunks, which is also quite an interesting way of like organizing a text, right?
Yes. So that's so interesting for a few reasons. I mean, orality has its own kind of pace, and our attention is different to things that are orally communicated versus written. And I have so many ways that I could go with this next question, but I did want to ask you around this idea. I just recently read an article that you sent me, the article on Kuhn and this new text that's coming out around his writing that was never published. And one of the things that's sort of highlighted in that article is that Kuhn's, you know, paradigm shift. Jesus, what's the name of the book now? The
Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Thank you. Was so well received, so popular, and taken up by so many disciplines. And it caused Kuhn a great deal of distress as a result, because so many people then also misconstrued a lot of what he was saying. He was getting into a lot of arguments in ways that he was extremely grumpy about. And so he then set forth to write a book on purpose that was almost unreadable to most people, unless they were experts. And I find this really interesting, because the goal there is almost a gatekeeper goal, right? And I think about the suttas and the Old Testament and all sorts of other philosophical texts, that there is a sense of, unless you're willing to put the time and the effort to come with me into this really dense world, I don't want you here with me at all. Is there something there that you think is right?
Well, it's fascinating. I hadn't really... So that article is in the London Review of Books, and I will link to it in the show notes. I hadn't connected that before to the Nietzsche quote, which I think is in the Gay Science, where he says, we don't only write to be understood, we also write to be misunderstood yes. by the wrong people. And so he basically says, we don't write just inclusively, we write to exclude, right? Mm-hmm. And so we, like, it creates a kind of out-group, I suppose, by its impenetrability. Yeah. And I don't know, there's something to it, right? Like this idea that, yeah, and I mean, you could go into all kinds of modern political directions with what's going on there, but it is an interesting idea, right? That you want to make your thought easy and accessible to the kind of people who would benefit from it. And you maybe want it to be off-putting to the kinds of people that wouldn't benefit from it, or something like that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And not only benefit, but also contribute to the dialogue in a way that is helpful and doesn't, you know, bring you two steps backward after you've gone a bit ahead, right? So I think that part is also really important. I mean, I worry about this even with this podcast, right? On the one hand, we have the goal of sort of excavating the various elements of neither nor that are sometimes stuck in your head or your daily pages or your writing in other contexts. And so we want to get this out, air it out, think through these ideas together, first you and I, and then open it up to anyone else who's really interested in joining that conversation. But necessarily this conversation excludes a whole lot of people that might not be able to follow along with the philosophy, or of course what we're hoping is that we can be as accessible as possible. But I think about this all the time. When should we stop and explain certain elements and not others for the sake of flow and so on?
Yeah, and I think there is, I like the way you put it, and there's a kind of excavation element and a kind of airing out element, probably a sculpting element in there as well. Kind of yeah. like unearth it, sculpt it, and then, yeah, kind of air it out. The Kuhn thing is interesting because I kind of think I disagree with him, or like it's, you know what I mean? Like he was a victim of his own success because the book was so readable to the lay public and such a profound set of ideas, but he felt that they weren't really understood. He didn't like most of his fans. He felt that they were often... He felt that they misunderstood what he was saying about science in particular, right? He thought yeah. that they came away with the idea that he was anti-science, which he certainly was not. And he insisted that, you know, right the way through. And so then there's this strange dynamic that he has more sympathy for his critics than he does for his allies.
Right.
And he kind of is in some sense a scientist, and yet philosophers immediately see him as coming into their territory. But because they kind of see him as a historian of science, which he didn't like because he wanted to be a philosopher. And because he is... I'm trying to think of like what the dynamic was exactly.
What do you mean by it? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so he sees himself as a philosopher, right? And the philosophers sense that he's stepping into their territory, but because they regard him as a scientist, they kind of don't take him all that seriously. At the same time, because he sees himself as a philosopher, he only really listens to the critiques from philosophers. He's not really interested in the, you know, scientific critique of what he's on about, or even mm-hmm. the history of science critique. So there's just like a bunch of like really interesting dynamics going on there. And the fact that it did just kind of like make him an unwitting celebrity in a strange sense. Mm-hmm. You know, he sold millions of these books, even though it's not, you know, it just is not a normal thing to happen to an academic book, right?
To say the least, to say the least. Yeah. And so I do think this is a really interesting, it's also a really interesting juxtaposition going back to the original question I had starting today's session on Janes. And so Janes is this almost opposite creature in terms of his writing tome. It is by many people regarded as inaccessible to most, you know, minds, because it crosses all sorts of disciplines, also has this incredible interweaving of very hard scientific facts, or at least very supportable theories with evidence and so on in scientific sort of context, and wild speculations. And it's not always clear which is which from his own perspective and his own writing. And so I'm wondering the degree to which you think Kuhn and Janes, how they might be related in your mind, not just in terms of how they're writing, of course, because that's somewhat superficial, but also what they were thinking in terms of revolutions and how they work across sort of time, evolutionary versus, you know, disciplinary and so on.
I think they're very related in the sense that they both see things historically, and as you say, in terms of these revolutions or kind of shifts of level. One of the places that this comes through in Janes, it's a kind of Kuhnian move in a sense, because Kuhn, you know, has this sense of real discontinuities, right? Where a paradigm shift completely changes the landscape and it's kind of unrecognizable. And yet it also papers over this fact such mm-hmm. that you can't easily see that this has happened. And one place where Janes does this, and when I heard it, I was like, this is absolutely preposterous. And then since then, and this is probably a bad sign, you know, this is becoming an obviousness for me. Like, I can't get it out of my head and I can't stop thinking in this terms. He's like, well, obviously, like, the parts of speech had to have developed at different times. And so what he's saying is, like, there had to be a time when adverbs existed, but nouns didn't. And I was like, wait, what? And he tries to go and prove that basically, you know, there's a period before there are kind of stable objects, and yet there are kind of directions you can give to someone. So something like a command or like an instruction might, you know, that I can kind of see, right? Like, you would say, go over there, right? Like, apes do this, right? Mm-hmm. With a gaze. You can kind of see that that might be like an early part of speech. But then he tries to go on and say, well, something like a command, something like sharper, has to be one of the first words. And then he kind of says, well, and then he tries to prove when each of these would have happened. So basically, he thinks, you know, like, when the first signs of art come around, whenever that is, like 40, 50,000 years ago, then that's like the kind of noun phase, whereas like the adverb phase was earlier. And like, it's just this wild argument, but like, yes. You see what I mean? Like, he's seeing the historicity of it, right? He's saying we can't understand things from the finalized form, because that's not how kind of evolutionary things work. And I think we're going to have to really be careful about what we mean by cultural evolutionary theory. I was just talking to Maggie today about some of the problems that faced in the 20s, even separately from the social Darwinist stuff of the 19th century. But the other side of this coin, I guess, is that language or linguistics is so subject to Darwinian principles. You know what I mean? Like, we can apply essentially genetic reasoning to figure out when a language dialect split off, and in what order, and where did this, you know, where did the Polynesian languages originate? And it works so well that, like, we can't kind of write off evolutionary thinking entirely in all cultural domains. Like, not that I'm saying that anyone is saying that we should do that, but, like, there, again, there's kind of like pitfalls on both sides. There's pitfalls of overusing this evolutionary thinking, but there's also a danger of just like ignoring it when it is clearly present. And so I think when you start to look at language itself in these evolutionary terms, you have to start to kind of think, well, there's a lot of chicken and egg problems. Like, these things are clearly now interdependent, you know, in terms of nouns and verbs and whatever else we find in the languages that we happen to be using. But those problems are sort of more like the kinds of problems you see in biology with, like, well, how can, you know, what came first in terms of, I don't know, like meiosis and sexual reproduction. That's a bad example, but you know what I mean? Like, there are these things in biology where you're like, they're kind of so interdependent, we don't actually know how this could have come about, you know, like, and so there are things like that in language. I guess I'm just saying that when we think about, like, well, were there periods where nouns existed, but proper names, proper nouns didn't? Well, probably. And so then, but that kind of question is more like a question about biology. Like, how did this mitochondria situation come about? And it's this really complicated answer, which you can never really fully answer, rather than kind of solving a question about engineering or something like that. Because languages aren't designed by humans, right? Mm-hmm. They kind of evolve in this cultural way. And I don't want to bring in memetics particularly, but just saying that, like, it's just too useful to think about languages in these kind of genetic terms to not do it. And at the same time, there's huge dangers to doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when you think about what Kuhn and how he would think about these shifts in, you know, uses of pieces of language or grammatical forms, I think this whole, the historicity part is that they do become obviousnesses that you can't look at anymore once the paradigm shift has taken place, that it's impossible. It's not impossible, but it's no longer the scientist's even purview to go into and look at what happened before these paradigm shifts, right?
Yes. And I think maybe just to the most fundamental and kind of basic level, what is similar about Kuhn and James? Sorry. What is similar between Kuhn and James is that they're willing to ask very hard questions about how a seemingly obvious state of affairs came about, right? And so they're looking at the present and saying, well, here's obviously how science works in the case of Kuhn, or here's obviously what we think the gods were in the case of Jaynes, and then going back and saying, but this can't be right. And so basically they're taking the kind of, they're dismantling the obvious view of history,
yes,
which is teleological. It basically is leading up to the present in some kind of progressive sense. And they're looking at it and taking apart each part and saying, this is not how it happened if you look at the history. And so, or let's say that the closer you look at the history, the less plausible the received history seems. So as you zoom into the details of what was happening in the chemical revolution, or you zoom into the details of why does every human culture talk about gods as if they're real before a certain point? And, you know, maybe there's a naive answer to that. Well, we discovered oxygen and that one thing led to another. Or people just used to be weird and naive and superstitious, and now they're not. And it's like those two stories don't account well for the details of the history.
Right. Yeah. I think that's so interesting. And so I think it would be also really useful. And I don't think we've mentioned Althusser's idea of obviousnesses many times in our conversations, but I don't think you've ever actually just paused and explained his perspective, because it's so useful and important and has become almost an obviousness between us when we give our, you know, we have some conversations about these things. But I think it would be useful for the listener to hear a little bit about what Althusser says about obviousnesses.
Yeah, so this is Louis Althusser, and I don't know a huge amount about him except that he's a Marxist critic writing in the early 70s. And his most famous essay, which is one that was recommended to me by two brilliant and wildly different thinkers that I know, one being Vincent Bevins and another being Ernest Mitchell. And they both said I needed to read this paper. And so after many years of procrastinating, I finally did. And of course, it blew my mind. And I thought I should have read this much earlier. And the essay is called Ideological State Apparatuses. And the argument on the whole is that within a society, you might expect repressive state apparatuses to enforce the status quo. So this is a kind of Marxist critique saying, well, you might expect that in order for the owners of capital to be able to extract the excess value of labor, then they would have to use force all the time. In practice, force is rarely used, right? It was used more in the early 20th century, but today it's pretty unusual. For example, like, you know, we've got Amazon workers. I'm sure we have big problems with them, but they're not being whipped, probably. I'm not saying that they're not under other kinds of, you know, more metaphorical violence or, you know, really bad situations in other ways. But why is it that this mechanism seems to be not used that much? And so he's saying, well, in addition to the kind of top-down power that's enforced, and by the way, I don't think this, although this critique comes from a kind of Marxist perspective, I think it's super insightful and useful, and everyone should read this essay. It's a brilliant essay. Mm-hmm. It kind of operates at a level above anything even to do with capitalism. It's just it's an incredible essay. So what it's really talking about is the question of why is top-down order, why is a top-down ordering principle so rarely necessary? So in other words, if you want to enforce, let's just say you want to enforce a rule in a classroom or something, you might very occasionally have to like punish someone in some way, right? But in general, you only have to do that like very occasionally. And over time, it kind of stops being needed. And what Althusser is saying is that some kind of bottom-up principle is operating whereby the participants in this society internalize the kind of top-down ordering principle to such a degree that they self-enforce, right? Mm-hmm. So, and he's, you know, specifically saying that there are these emergent social constructions that are not built by an extractive state. You know, for example, one of the kind of mind-blowing things in this, and this came up recently in a Bloom discussion, was just trade unions he considers one of the ideological state apparatuses. And this is surprising, right? Because he's saying that unions are a mechanism for maintaining the status quo of capitalism, which on the face of it is surprising, right? Because we think of unions as being this form of resistance. But he's saying, no, it's kind of like a form of appeasement, right? So he's saying that all of these things, whether it's the church or education or trade unions, are supporting the status quo of the way that we understand, for example, education to relate to labor or things like that. So yeah. In other words, these, for him, and it's a pretty radical position, but it's like really interesting. These things are not designed by the person enforcing the rules, right? That's pretty clear. Like in, at least in countries where there is a strong separation of church and state, or even when you have, for example, an, you know, large percentage of the population that's atheist or whatever, and yet they still form some kind of social organizations, and those organizations are compatible with the conditions of society. So this is the overall...
This is very also for those who might have been reading more recently The Dawn of Everything or The Utopia of Rules by David Graeber. This is very much underlying a lot of Graeber's argument, certainly in The Utopia of Rules where I read it. I haven't read that yet. This kind of sort of bottom-up constraints that people don't see any longer as such.
Yeah, and it's really funny because this comparison has struck me too, that Althusser must have really influenced Graeber. And I think I've searched Graeber's works and he only refers to him like once or twice, and it's always critically. So it relates to a kind of point that we may have discussed before, that sometimes you hide your biggest influences, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, Nietzsche clearly is influenced by Darwin, but he has very little nice to say about him, really. And so there's possibly a similar thing going on between Althusser and Graeber. But to return to the ideological state apparatus's point,
yes,
what Althusser is saying is that the way this kind of bottom-up enforcement of rules operates is through ideology. And ideology is just like a set of assumptions. It's kind of like a worldview. You might actually compare it to a Kuhnian paradigm, actually.
Right.
And so it is a kind of totalizing worldview. But one of the interesting features of it is that people almost are never aware of the assumptions that their own ideology imposes on them, right?
So exactly.
They don't see that they are in ideology. And he says that he kind of thinks there is no view from nowhere, in the words of Thomas Nagel or whatever. He thinks that the best you can do is be aware that you are in ideology. And interestingly, he thinks that only Spinoza and Marx, or rather followers of Spinoza and of Marx, kind of own this and say, yes, you are always in an ideology, therefore we pick ours and here's what it is. And they try to stay aware of that. And he thinks that, although he thinks that one of the surest signs that you are in ideology is the insistence that you're not, basically.
Yes.
Which is like one of those, like, kind of denial is the first sign of addiction. And it's like,
yeah.
Well, how do you, then is everyone addicted? Because some people are going to say, well, I'm not addicted. And it's like, well, then you're addicted. It's,
yes,
like, it's kind of like circular thing.
And it very much relates to a previous conversation we had on Pyrrhonism and skepticism, right? And this idea that, can you, in fact, continue in a context in which you are questioning and continually being skeptical of any dogma without itself becoming a dogmatic stance?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think it is a danger. So one of the things that he says is that all ideology imposes obviousnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, anything, any viewpoint, and especially any unexamined viewpoint, will have these things that are just unquestionable. And so they're kind of like axiomatic or something like that. I'm trying to think of like an example he gives. I know he does this thing about appellation, as in like the calling sense. So, you know, to be subject to power is like a police officer calling you and saying like, hey, you. And then there's this moment where you realize that he's talking about you, and you both become a subject in the sense of like highly self-conscious, and also you become subjected to power simultaneously. And he thinks that these two forms of subjectification are related, so that basically the subject as agent of action is always subjected to power. And so there's something interesting going on in that example, which is to do with self-consciousness, which we could probably talk about some other point. But like, I guess the point is that in that context, the obviousness might be something like, if a police officer tells you to do something, you have to do it, right? Yes. And that's just like an obvious thing that's being a part of society. And like, you, in most cases, you don't need to actually question this, right? Because it's just obvious that that's what you have to do, right?
Yes.
And so,
but I wonder if that is almost more of an example that people will be like, yes, yes, and that we should question maybe, or that would be interesting. The most compelling obviousnesses that seem to come up in the context of neither nor are sort of the David Foster Wallace water kind of thing, right? Like,
yes.
You know, the context in which we swim in, we talk in, our linguistic habits, our assumptions around, you know, what is progress, what is success, those kinds of things that we really don't even, we not only not question when it is brought to us, like what Jane's does, we think it's preposterous. You don't understand it. It's like as if somebody's speaking to you in an entirely different language. You don't understand the assumptions or how to break the assumptions.
Yeah, so to bring it back to Jane's for a second, an obviousness that we might have now, and I'm not saying everyone has this, I'm just saying that it might be a common one, is that whatever was going on in the late Bronze Age or whatever, people weren't actually talking to gods, right? And Jane's is saying like, well, no, they were talking to gods. And so like, this is like,
yeah,
one of those things that like, I think Epicurus talks about this. He's like, obviously there are gods. And when we read this today, we think like, what does he mean by that? But he may just mean like phenomenologically there, it's just obvious that there are gods. And, you know, from our set of obviousnesses, this seems like a confusing statement, but like from his point of view, it may not. And
that's because there is a phenomenological experience, not just a ideological one that you're reading books and you need to believe really hard in gods. It's that you're hearing voices that are don't identify as yourself in your head, that feel like they're also outside of your head. And it could be an actual physical manifestation of the brain working in a very different way. So the point that I want to make is that this isn't just about ways of believing or having these, you know, superstitions. It's actually the experience in time of a person or many people who have a consensus of hearing these voices.
Yeah, that's totally right. So it's important to be clear about Jane's claim. And Jane's claim is that the way we made decisions in the late Bronze Age-ish, and less so as time went on, was that in periods of uncertainty, a god would just appear before us, whether in the form of a voice or in the form of a visual. You know, he uses the word hallucination in some places, that this kind of god consciousness, in the sense of like your consciousness is taken over by a god, and that's what they mean by the word god, is just an everyday occurrence whenever you face uncertainty, that a, you know, Hermes pops up and says go over there or whatever in this, yes, kind of like very matter of fact way. And you know, he tries to draw evidence from the Iliad, where he claims that humans don't make any decisions. Anytime there's an uncertainty, then a god just pops up. Or, you know, the god of Genesis, who does not seem to be a matter of belief for people like Adam and Eve, or specifically Cain. I guess he likes Abel, but Abel's kind of gone by the point that God starts talking to Cain. But I wanted to also go back to this point about what is an obviousness, because Althusser gives some extremely profound examples. Like, I kind of gave a not that great example of this police officer one, but he says, you know, one obviousness that is required to be a part of a society is that words have meaning.
Right.
And it's like, well, yeah, obviously. And he's like, exactly. That feeling that it's obvious shows that you are already kind of a part of this apparatus, right? And again, although the critique is about sort of ways that capitalism is reproduced, it's a much more general critique. It's basically saying, look, anytime you have that feeling that, well, yeah, obviously words have meaning, he's like, that's a sign of an ideological commitment. What does an ideological commitment mean in this context? And he goes back to the French ideologues. So these are guys in France in the 1790s, really. They are at first, they're kind of aligned with the revolution, and then eventually Napoleon gets kind of bored of their stuff, and then he does the Concordat with the Catholic Church, I think at 1801 or something like that, and then he kind of distances himself from these so-called ideologues. But the ideology was originally the study of ideas and how they develop and how they affect things. Mm-hmm. And so when he talks about being in ideology, it's a little confusing, but it's like, I suppose it is like having a shared worldview, something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the issue actually is that we don't have very clear delineations of these when we are in or out, and they're probably also overlapping ideologies and their obviousnesses that we are unaware of. But I just think that the very idea is so powerful, because as soon as we start imagining or even being attuned to the possibility that there are obviousnesses that we are not aware of, the questions become more interesting, and they become historical questions, as you first started off with thinking about Kuhn and Jaynes as both historical thinkers.
Yeah, and as like a brief teaser that is an enormously large point, where neither nor comes to with this is that all concepts are cultural artifacts that are generated by some kind of evolutionary processes. That means they have a birth in time. That means they are subject to kind of evolutionary pressure over time. They shift meanings a lot. They change. And yet they can be so baked into the kind of fabric of society that we don't perceive them as things that have a beginning in history, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, just this idea that something like an iPhone now is this just obviously self-evidently natural part of our reality. But of course, you know, a few decades ago, that has no meaning at all. And so that's just an extreme example. But like, what I'm saying in neither nor is that all words are like iPhone.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is that there was a time before there was this word. And knowing about an iPhone doesn't tell you a lot about how microprocessors developed in the 20th century, the developments in different types of architecture, in, you know, computing architecture, and it doesn't tell you anything about the mining techniques required to get the rare earth metals to make these things. It tells you none of that, right? Mm-hmm. And yet all of those are necessary conditions for the existence of the iPhone, right? So here we're going into Buddhist territory.
But I was just going to say.
Yeah, exactly.
You might want to actually, I think it's really important. It is the next one that I wanted to talk about in terms of the Buddha and some of that. Obviously, we do not have time for the entire framework laid out by Buddhist thought. But I think the connection to what you just talked about in terms of the iPhone, it's not about the fact that everyone now should be super aware of every historical step that went into any term we use, any object we use, etc., but that there is a mindset and even practices that help us at least be aware of this sort of background historicity of all phenomena. And then there's something that we can do with that kind of awareness. So maybe would you like to just think a little bit with us about how Buddhist thought helps us kind of see through these obviousnesses?
Yeah, so I think Buddhist dependent origination, which I've written about before and we've spoken about on the podcast, gives really important insights into this. Just to go back for a second to the iPhone example, you're completely right that the point is not to learn every condition. It's the only reason I use the iPhone example is to give an example where we are very aware that this is a new thing and a complicated thing, and yet we have this tendency to make it into a kind of omnipresent, obvious thing, right? That we just know, we have this strong feeling, or at least I have this strong feeling, that I know what someone means when they say iPhone, that it's kind of obvious, that I know what it looks like, I know what it can do, I know all of these things about it. But that kind of hides a lot of the history. So the point in choosing the iPhone is not because there's any particular utility in deconstructing that concept per se, but just to say that even a very new thing can become reified as an apparent obvious part of reality, right? And yet, and that's even when we know just how constructed it is. And so it's much harder for us to see something like religion or culture or other words that we use like that, or history, as themselves essentially being constructs something like the iPhone. I don't think that's what's not obvious. And that's why it's important, because some of these concepts can lead to big problems, basically. The iPhone is not the one that I'm aiming to deconstruct. It's just like an easier example to think about, you know?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And it is very much related to, you know, current political problems. But even if you've ever had the experience of, and part of why I'm so interested in having these cross-generational discussions, is that it's extremely clear very quickly the obviousnesses that you do not share when you talk to your grandmother or when you talk to even your parent. And not just about technology, but the sort of assumptions around, you know, values, or the assumption so much is, and the interesting thing is that if we never have those discussions outside of our own watery existence of our own type of aquarium, then those obviousnesses are even harder to see. But I agree with you that things like, you know, capitalism or money or having a job at all or having children or any of the kinds of things that we think of as valuable in one context are not obvious in others if we take them apart or look at their histories is the most important part of that, I think.
Yeah, and that's a very kind of Graeber way of looking at it. I mean, money is one, debt is the one that he really takes apart. And he says, you know, this idea that debt is something that should be repaid is quite new, which is already mind-blowing, that statement. It's like, how could that possibly be true? Isn't a debt, like, by definition and by every obvious thing, like, that's what it means. It has to be repaid.
Yes.
And he's like, nope, that's not how most cultures work. And that's not how they've worked, you know, and that's not how debt works throughout history. Yes, people have always been indebted to each other, have always owed things to each other. But the idea that they should be repaid, that is new.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like,
yeah,
you know, and, you know, he does similar things with money. You know, we think, well, you have to pay for things. That's another example of an obviousness, right? That's quite new. It's not a human universal. It's not, you know, and I'm not going to go into that now, but just to make the point that those are the kind of places where you might want to intervene using this kind of framework.
Yeah. And one of the other thinkers around this idea that comes to mind right away is Lewis Hyde and what he talks about in The Gift. He covers both this idea of debt and indebtedness. And money and this idea that what we give to one another and what we work on for hours and hours per day does not have to be a something that's monetized. And not only does it not have to be, but it arguably shouldn't be. And so there's all sorts of questions around how what value we put on the things that we trade and so on that are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And we could go into endless examples. You know, the idea of selling time is quite new, right? Like this idea of working hours or something like that, rather than working for some kind of, you know, year or yield of something that you're doing. You know?
Yes, exactly. And but to go back to dependent origination, I think it's really important to say, so we have these obviousnesses, and then we have this practice of dependent origination that the Buddha suggested might be helpful to sort of reclaim what? Tell me a little bit about how you think of those things as related.
In my view, the Buddhist claim, or one of the central ones, is that the reified conceptual self is an obviousness that comes up quite frequently and that causes a lot of problems. So there's this claim about dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness, something we don't want to have. And this is linked in Buddhist thinking to a kind of delusion and not seeing things clearly. So in my understanding of dependent origination, the idea is that all views, you know, to take the Pyrrhonist kind of view, are potentially problematic. But the Buddhists say that the self view is the most pernicious one, or that it might be so kind of infectious that it prevents you from seeing the truth about other concepts. So it's just like the kind of just an expedient means kind of sense. It's one of the most efficacious to dismantle early on. And most people have a kind of reaction to this notion that the self is illusory or something like that. They feel that it certainly does not seem that way. There obviously seems to be a me. And when I say I seem to mean something by it. Yes. And that is a kind of obviousness that seems to come out of a certain type of ideology, right? Again, in the broadest sense. And so this idea that self-view is the first one to be dismantled, I kind of think that dependent origination is a more general framework for dismantling any concept, basically, but that it's importantly used for this kind of sense of mindness, which comes about relatively transparently or obviously or naturally for people with modern minds like ours, or I should say modern ways of seeing things like ours, as well as minds that are modern like the Buddha's. Because I do think that the Buddha has many of the same features of the kind of modern problems with cognition, even if he's not fully modern. And this is a thing that I've been going back and forth with Jake Orthwine about, the degree to which the Buddha can be considered to have a modern mind.
And when you say that, is that modern in the sense of post bicameral?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, yeah, so another way of looking at this division between the Buddha and what may have come before in the kind of, you know, there's this idea of the Axial Age that comes out of Carl Jaspers, and maybe something happened in this time when a lot of the world's religions and philosophies get born, as we've kind of talked about before. Another way to see it is that, yeah, the phenomenology of it was different. The Jains' argument that they were experiencing gods. I think there's at least like weak evidence in the Buddhist suttas that the problem is new. The problem of the problem that's addressed by dependent origination is new. The Buddha uses this phrase, this generation is tangled up, which seems like an odd thing to say if his belief is that this is just endemic to humanity. And it seems like an odd thing to say if this is just endemic to human nature as he sees it. You know what I mean? Like, yes. If he's saying, if this is just part of what life is like, then why is he saying this generation is tangled up in suffering and delusion?
Right.
It seems like something might have changed. And that's kind of what I'm trying to weakly argue. I'm not taking the whole Jane's line necessarily, nor do I think it's like super important to figure out which parts of the Buddha's brain are, you know, or the Buddha's way of cognizing or whatever are similar to ours versus not similar to ours. I'm not trying to make a strong claim like that, but I am saying that I do think it's possible something changed around that time, and also that the Buddha's, maybe the Buddha gets it before other people because he's relatively wealthy and has, you know, access to kind of a sedentary lifestyle or something like that. You know, there's famous stories of him being quite coddled, I guess, until he's about 20 or whatever. And then he goes out and sees all these horrible things or whatever. He's never seen suffering or old age or sickness or death or whatever the four things that he sees are. I'm probably really pissing off a lot of Buddhists by my lack of knowledge of this story, but you know.
Yeah, but I think the main point is that you're suggesting that there was a pressure, a problem to solve that perhaps, at least if it wasn't entirely new, was newly being perceived. So it was newly recognized as a source of suffering. And that perception was about this sort of self, this centralized self that was kind of running things inside us as some kind of homunculus. And that this is kind of one of the first times that people were not only recognizing it as such, but also recognizing it as a source of suffering.
Yeah, and I think there is kind of a lot of evidence that something changes, right? Just, I spent about a year with a discussion group that I have just reading different creation accounts. And most of them have this notion that things used to be better. They don't all have this, but like many of them say, you know, before this certain time, we were in the Garden of Eden, or before this certain time, people were titans, and before that they were gods or something like that, you know, or, you know, before this time there was no motion. I think the Zoroastrian one says something like that. There's, you know, there is this notion that something has changed to result in this new situation, which we find unsatisfactory in some way. And
although I do want to wonder whether that is, you know, pointing to something that's common or something historical and evolutionary that might have happened over thousands and tens of thousands of years, or whether there's something about human nature, because you see this in the one of the most consistent generational changes or shifts that happens, but consistently for every generation, is this: back in my time, it was better. And so there is something interesting to wonder whether that's just the way our tendency as we age, just it's a function of us being more idealizing our past or comfortable with our past or comfortable or idealizing our own sense of self when we were young versus old and so on, and how much that has to do with then the written scripts and so on about past times.
Yeah, I've heard versions of that argument before, which I think usually goes something like, you know, we can only see from our own perspective. And as we get older, our bodies age and we have these problems and we kind of decay and we have less energy. And therefore we view the world as somehow itself being worse than when we were young, even though it's really we that are in decline. Is that what you're kind of describing, or?
I yes, and not exactly, because I think that the sentimentality that we have about our own period and the way that we kind of have rose colored glasses when we look back. And by the way, this isn't in all contexts. You can imagine people like Holocaust victims and others that have gone through terrible atrocities may have a very different way of looking at their own past. But this, yes, we tend to idealize our youth because we were strong and healthy and so on. But there is also this other very ubiquitous finding of the U-shaped happiness curve, where people are generally reporting that they're a hell of a lot happier post 65 and older. And this is not because of retirement, but because of perceptions of being the here and now, that death is near, and that they have less time. And contrary to everybody's, you know, assumption that death is a scary thing, that people would actually be more miserable about knowing that it's coming, most people actually end up feeling better about their day-to-day lives. It's like the post-cancer survivors who are much happier after they've gone through, you know, treatment and come out of it and feel like it was actually a gift to be that sick because being so close to death. Anyway, so my main point there is that it's not that necessarily that we're happier in our youth, but that we do tend to nostalgize it, if anything. And so that this kind of fairy tale storytelling way of telling our past may be part of how we're writing down our myths and so on.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that brains have been shrinking for the last 100,000 years. So it's also possible that every generation is just right, and that
yes,
things have been getting worse for the last 100,000 years in some important sense. I am kind of more attracted to that idea than the idea that we just...
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Well, I think it is important because there... I guess one other way we could look at this question, one that Schopenhauer uses, is to compare humans to animals. So you mentioned maybe it's just part of human nature to be slightly dissatisfied. I've had conversations with Robert Wright, and I know that he thinks that this is just a built-in thing. But mm-hmm. I think it's also possible that dukkha, like we're saying, everything in the neither nor framework, and dukkha just means unsatisfactoriness. It's a Buddhist term, right? And so this dissatisfaction, let's just call it for the sake of this argument, may itself be a form of technology that wins out over happier modes of being through some kind of form of selection, basically. Mm-hmm. And that basically people who are less happy tend to do more stuff. And this somehow just, you know, like, it's not a built-in thing. In other words, it's something we do to ourselves culturally.
Yes.
And that may be hard to justify or argue on a historical basis. It's, I mean, for one thing, because most of history comes from people who write things down. Most people who write things down seem to have this problem that we're describing.
Right.
It's just, yes, like, it may just be that literacy is highly tied to this very problematic sense of dissatisfaction, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying I have a strong view on that. I'm just saying it's a possibility. The other thing is, you know, well, you've got cats, and they
I certainly do
seem to have something like dissatisfaction, certainly.
Oh, so little, though. I mean, yes, they... Yes, I see what you're saying.
One in particular. But, like, at the same time, they're not dissatisfied. They don't seem dissatisfied in the same way we do. And when I see wilder animals, I mean, they're still subject to some kind of human interactions. There's a fox that lives quite close to my house in London, and he has figured out that the fence, like, there's a chain link fence near the tube station, and he knows that humans can't get in. So he is completely chill in there and will just sit there and just, like, watch you take pictures of him and things like that in the daytime. And so he's probably not a good example of a wild, quote unquote, wild animal. Like, he's kind of domesticated. But his level of chill is one that I don't think I have ever seen in a human, right, just with his lot in life.
Yeah.
And this is something I've disagreed with Jake about as well. We kind of have an ongoing discussion that's we may eventually try to have in person, or, you know, that we may eventually try to have on the air or something, about whether wolves are satisfied with being wolves. And my strong instinctual feeling is that they are pretty happy with that. And he's like, no, it must be miserable. But
really, I'm surprised.
Schopenhauer kind of like talks about this because he thinks that on the one hand, humans are kind of capable of much more variety of emotion and passion, but with this comes much greater suffering that you don't see, for example, in pigeons. I mean, this is the problem, is that I live in a city.
I'm mostly talking about foxes.
I'm talking about commensals who have this close contact with humans. They're subject to really intense selection pressures, surely, even the squirrels and rats and mice and whatever. So like, these are probably all bad examples, but my feeling, even from these quote unquote tainted animals, is that they are just much more chill than humans are. You know, these pigeons,
well, and the important
half of them
part,
don't have feet. They just seem deeply fine with that in a way.
Yeah. I mean, the important part, even with these two cats that I live with and who are obviously deeply, you know, socialized to hang out with us, they, even their dissatisfaction is so, like, the thing that is most obvious about that is that they're so easily satisfied. So you open the freaking door and the crying stops, the screeching stops, you know, you pet them, they've got it. You give them food, that's it. So it's very sort of, you know, stimuli response sort of things. There is no, as we talked about before, proliferation.
Yes.
There is nothing that looks like that, because as soon as you satisfy the need, it goes away. There's no, they curl up and go to sleep. That's it.
Yeah, this is kind of how Schopenhauer puts it. It's in the Essays and Aphorisms, and it's brilliant the way he says it. He's like, on this narrow basis of pain and pleasure, with the mere addition of thought comes this enormous, like, melodrama of suffering kind of thing, which is
that's
just
it.
You know,
that's
it's the thinking that's the problem, he
yep.
thinks, you know.
Absolutely, and he's not the only one. I mean, the Stoics, I mean, there's many people who have elaborated on the terrible, you know, effect of thought in general, or at least the proliferation idea, right? Rumination and other kinds of terms.
So if you think that cats don't have the same kind of dissatisfaction that humans have, then something must have changed, right? That's the part that I always get a bit confused by, because you can't just say, well, it's human nature to have suffering, because what does human nature mean? Like, mm-hmm, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like,
yeah,
that's exactly what we're trying to work out. So to just kind of like,
agreed. I think that's exactly the interesting question. Where, when, why kind of thing. What selection pressures were there to have this? I mean, people talk about planning, right? People talk about, you know, when we had to kind of figure out that at night is where we get our best chance to get the, you know, the prey or whatever it is. You had to have some level of social, you know, organization and planning. And as soon as you have planning for shit that's going to go down that you didn't expect or don't want to happen and so on. And there comes anxiety. And, you know, so there, you can see it come out pretty quickly from, but obviously this is all speculation in terms of how brain develops. It also reminds me of Jane Goodall's work. And I would love to go back into it and look at the differences between her chimps and us, because she certainly did a really great job of observing them for, you know, years and years in their own habitat and what felt natural, quote unquote, and what felt very different from humans and so on.
Right. And did you ever read Walter Ong? Because that was at the start of the conversation that
No.
I was thinking about orality and literacy.
No, tell me a little bit about
it. I haven't read it, but just it was another one that maybe we should have a look at.
Sounds
in the
great.
Sense of, he's a McLuhan related person, I think.
Ooh.
So he's in your neck of the woods. But just the question of oral cultures, I guess.
I think that should definitely be on our to read list and to think list and to talk about list. And we got through Kuhn, Althusser, and the Buddha and how they relate to Jains today. So that wasn't a small task for this session. And I'm really glad we got to those because I think it's really, you can see how these ideas are intertwined and how the themes of obviousnesses and phase transitions is the word I keep using, but paradigm shifts and then just the relation between individual suffering and the obviousnesses that we go through versus thinking about more societal and cultural shifts and whether we are suffering more or less than we ever were. All of these themes, I think, are going to keep coming back up for us as we keep talking.
Yeah, I think that's great. And at some point, we're going to need to talk about individual suffering versus group suffering, but we will probably come back to that sometime soon, hopefully.
I've got it in my notes. So let's do that. All right. Thank you, Brian. It's been
great
talking.
Thank you, Isabella. Great to talk.
Bye.
Bye. This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.